What's up? Welcome back, one and all. This is Soft Revolution, the podcast for and about art and politics. I'm Torkel Campbell.
I'm Allie Moman.
Allie, what episode is this? I don't even want to think. 24?
This is 23.
Is it 23?
No, 23. Yeah, 23 Michael Jordan. This is the Michael Jordan episode.
That's right. 23 weeks since we first spoke and this pandemic really kicked in. And on it goes. I am now out in British Columbia, where today we went from 12 cases 3 weeks ago to 90 cases today. This fucking virus, man, just doesn't quit. And we were just talking before we got on air that it's a long haul, and it feels like a really, really long haul. And today it's kind of killing me. We are going to, today on the show, we've got nothing except me and Allie, because we haven't spoken for a while. And next week we're going to have a really amazing guest who also happens to be my first cousin. I swear to God, it's a coincidence. Her name is Zawn Wiley, and she works on a program in New York City to bring art to prisoners in Rikers Island, which is one of the most notorious and terrible jails in all of America. Maybe one day I'll tell you about the time I almost got sent there. But Zawn is attempting to collate a kind of giant pile of art for prisoners, music, dance recordings, whatever she can find. She's trying to put together a database because she really believes that art might save some people's lives in that situation. Prison right now is always a terrifying place, but a particularly terrifying one right now because of the spread of COVID-19 inside its walls. And there are a lot of disenfranchised and ignored and unheard and unseen people suffering in prisons. So Zawn is trying to bring the light through art. So we're really excited to have her next week. She was supposed to come this week, but she's too busy trying to save the world. So it's me and Allie trying to save our little corner of it. That's Allie, right? Moman, you're in Toronto, today or yesterday, you had 33 cases. How you doing, man? How is it over
30 something? Here crazy. It's it's good. We're walking around, we're all wearing our masks, we're getting through. And yeah, definitely.
Now, do you wear masks when you're outside?
No, we don't wear masks when we're outside, but we are mandated to wear a mask when you're inside. And to the point where even initially when they had the mask mandate, it was any indoor public place. And that didn't include a condo, which was weird for me because you think about it, like, what is the nastiest place? Yeah. The elevator, you're sitting there in the heat. But that changed very quickly. It was a nimble response by Mr. John Tory, and it got extended in Toronto that the mask mandate has to apply even to any kind of indoor space, including condo lobbies. And you know what? It's what's really cool about it is the policy really works, because I do not leave my house without putting my mask on now. Like, I open my door, and because I say, you have to have a mask just to walk into your hall, it's on, it's there. I don't think about it. It's all good. You get used to it. It's really, really bonkers.
I live in an apartment in Vancouver, and nobody wears a mask except for me. I get in the elevator, there's people with no masks on. It's very, very frustrating. I don't understand.
That is frustrating. There's something to talk about.
Yeah, Bonnie Henry, who's something. Well, Bonnie Henry, who's out here, who I've often lauded for her imaginative and sort of artistically empathetic approach to this pandemic. She has not mandated anything. There never was full lockdown in Vancouver, and she is against enforced mandates. And she has, she was sort of the first adopter of our advice in that 23 weeks ago, in that very first episode of our podcast, when we talked about imagination and empathy being a part of dealing with the public health crisis. She really used that, and she's been extremely good at that. But I do feel like there's a lot of dance out here and not a lot of hammer. And we are now seeing the consequences of letting your guard down even for 1 week in this fight. And it's scary, man. My kid is going back to school in 3 weeks. I don't know what that looks like. I don't know how dangerous that is. And I know that parents all over the world are experiencing that anxiety. And I'm also looking at the world of art, where this week there was a whole slew of, well, I don't know whether they're minor developments or major developments, but should we go through them sort of one by one?
Go through them. Yeah, you do one, I do one. Yeah.
So, Okay, so here's one that I thought was fascinating. There was a brass band choir in England who did a series of tests about how much droplets and aerosols were being expelled when they played their brass instrument. And they found, not surprisingly, that playing your brass instrument expelled a great deal of respiratory aerosols. But
I love when they empty out the spit when you're not looking. Yeah.
Yeah. But here's the huge, huge surprise in the study. This happened in Leeds, England. Apparently, according to this study, aerosols are released less by singing than by breathing. Now, that sounds completely counterintuitive. It sounds like it can't possibly be true, but I am looking at this chart right now, and it appears to be what they found. Now, you know, obviously one study doesn't tell all, and there might have been all kinds of variables involved in the results they got. But if this is true, you have to believe that Andrew Lloyd Webber et al. Are looking at this and thinking to themselves, Jesus, maybe we've got something here. Brass Bands England was the name of the organization that did the study. And here is their tweet that they put out about it. We've been working on some research on aerosol particles released by brass. Results, less particles released than singing. Using a cover can significantly reduce the release further. So the brass band found that playing brass instruments released less than breathing. So did singing. So I don't know what that means, and I don't know why it seems to follow such completely the opposite. This is the fucked up thing about this virus, is that just when you think you know what's going on, it flips on you. So what do you got?
I'm really starting to see our industry saying, okay, hold on, we need to find data, we need to get facts. This reminds me exactly of that Restart 19 project I was talking about in Germany, where, you know what, let's actually fill 1,000 people up, let's have a singer, let's actually monitor and analyze what these things actually do, as opposed to us assuming things. You know, they're learning new shit all the time. So I love this. I think we have to do another study, and I think industries need to do studies, and I think these studies need to be backed by government, because it's very important to bring culture back. Because this brings me to something that Daniel Silver emailed me yesterday. The Brookings Institute, they did a huge report on basically it's called Measuring COVID-19's Devastating Impact on America's Creative Economy. And kind of like the headline number here is that based on our creative industry analysis, we estimate losses of 2.7 million jobs and more than $150 billion in sales of goods and services for creative industries nationwide, representing nearly a third of all jobs in those industries and 9% of annual sales. Like, huge. And it's really interesting, this report. It's pretty big. But something that was actually, and they talk about how it is, this is really cool. The creative economy is one of the sectors most at risk from the COVID-19 crisis. Arts, culture, and creativity are one of the three key sectors, along with science and technology, as well as business and management, that drive regional economies. Any lasting damage to the creative sector will drastically undercut our culture, well-being, and quality of life. And this is from the Brookings Institute, right? So this is a legitimate organization that did a lot of due diligence in this report, a lot of work. This is what's happening now. I'm seeing it. I'm really seeing our industry and people who understand the importance of our industry, people waking up and figuring out we need to do something. And so I see that.
Yeah, it's being done in response to more concerning news. Our friend Miranda Mulholland forwarded me a new poll done by Abacus, which is a polling company here in Canada, that has pretty discouraging news about audiences' attitude towards the idea of returning to live music or theater. In Canada, at least, concern about the virus has actually increased instead of decreased. which is, I think, now makes sense because I think people's anxieties are going up because they're seeing how much people are out and they know that we can't keep living that way and expect it to stay down.
Right.
But it also shows this poll that while, you know, 90% of people polled said, I really miss going to concerts, and 89% of them said that digital contents could never replace the feeling of seeing live music. And, you know, there was 80% were upset about a festival cancellation. So there's a huge, huge sense of mourning and loss towards the lack of live music and live performance. But people are very, very, very scared to come back. And right. I think in this poll, they're saying more than 6 in 10 are still not likely to attend a gig, even with social distancing. So that's
interesting.
That's hit me hard this week. And I think that the Frank Turner show and a couple of other anecdotal things I've heard about people who've gone to socially distanced
shows. There was a concert in Newcastle, I believe. Yeah, socially distanced. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
And so what are you hearing from like your fellow musicians about playing it? What are you hearing about them playing it? How do they feel?
Well, I'm about to play one in a couple of weeks. And what I'm hearing is, I'm going to be real with you. What I'm hearing is it sucks and it feels sad.
Right.
So all this to say that this week I have been ruminating on the whole idea. And I think this ties into, you know, I feel like this podcast has been on kind of two tracks for the last couple of months. We've had one track where we're talking about the coronavirus and how the arts might return from the coronavirus and the threat it presents to live music, live theater, etc. And then the other track we've been talking about is the big ripple effects that have gone out into culture around the Black Lives Matter movement. And that has led to a discussion about whether institutional art is valid or not. Last week, we had Dave O'Brien on, who talked about that. Ravi Jain and you had a long discussion about that. And, you know, I've heard some things that I agree with. I've heard some things I don't agree with. But I have to ask myself at this point, are we whipping a dead horse here? Are we talking about something that right now isn't even relevant and that we don't have any chance to save right now? You know, my wife said to me the other night, Moya O'Connell, who's a fucking genius actor and director,
one
and
of the
artist
best
of all kinds. Yep, she's extraordinary. She said to me, I think that we as actors, she was speaking about the theater, but I think it applies to all artists. We have to ask ourselves, what do people need from us right now? They don't need us in the Royal Alex. They don't need Coachella. No. They don't need even a 600-seat theater, but they need us. So what do they need from us, and how do they need us to present it to them? And the answer, I think, it's one of those, she just said it and it was a simple thing to say, but it was profoundly true. And I think it sort of calmed my soul in a way, because if we get down to that basic question, if we accept that institutional art right now is in threat and it's going through transition and we all have our sides of the argument about whether or not it's valid, but right now it doesn't exist. And we all accept that it's going to be at least a year before institutional art can be relevant again. Then what does our audience need from us as artists? We need to start detaching ourselves from the notion that we are instruments of the state or instruments of institutional artistic places and start thinking of ourselves as entrepreneurs. And that is, if you don't have an entrepreneurial spirit right now and you intend to be an artist for the next two to three years, I'm not trying to be a jerk. I would advise you to give up.
You're fucked.
You're fucked. And like, I'm not trying to be mean. And not every artist has that. I get that. Not every artist wants to go out and hawk their shit or sell themselves. They feel self-conscious about it. Not every artist wants to, you know, do theater out of the back of their car or play to 20 people. But if you don't want to, you quit. Find something else to do.
Yeah.
Because the reality is, that's all there is right now. For the middle class and the lower middle class of art, all there is survival. And survival is about scrapping and hustling and coming up with your own hustle and making it happen in much the same way that all kinds of people in all kinds of industries have done. You know, you talk about adaptation. The restaurant industry has adapted. They are barely making it, but you see them doing things every day
to
completely revitalize. They're adapting. And all I see right now from the cultural scene, from the cultural milieu, is a kind of autopsy of the last 30 years of how fucked up everything was. Yeah, well, right. Here we are. So I don't know that we have that much more time for autopsies. I think we have to start getting on with being born again in whatever form that means. And so, you know, when I listened to you and Ravi talk a couple of weeks ago, I mean, I respect Ravi very much. I love his work. But to me, Ravi didn't come up with a forward plan. You know, you asked him at one point, what do you think the Shaw Festival, for example, should look like in the future? And he said to you, I don't know, but I'll know when I see it. I would put it to him, that's not good enough. That either we have to abandon these institutions or we have to accept that they exist and that they cannot be fixed when they aren't operating. And we have to start to focus on getting out into the community and saving some people's days, like literally just fucking making it easier to get through the day because it is hard right now. And if we're not doing that basic purpose in society as artists, I'm not sure we can justify or rationalize a bigger conversation about whether there should be a new deal for us, whether institutions should be saved, yada, yada, yada. Do you know what I'm saying? Sorry for the long rant, but I needed to get that out and I wanted to know.
No, I totally feel you. No, and I agree. You know, we talked about this last week about Teresa Tam saying that 2 to 3 year thing. That upset you because it is fucking annoying. But for me, and I think you're feeling it now too, it was a kick in my butt. I said, okay, this is the shit sandwich we're in. I've accepted it. This is what we're doing. And now it's time to adapt or die. We have to be Darwinian here. In respect to the notion of like, you know, listen, why we have to stop whining about these like large things that we can't do anymore. I'm going to put that aside because I have a point about that too. But the Brookings Institute did literally say at the end of their report, they said, with reduced demand for large cultural events as a result of social distancing, there is an opportunity for communities to shift to locally sourced culture. Communities can develop strategies to hire local creatives and create online portals and platforms to allow residents and businesses to hire local artists, musicians, and performers for smaller scale local events. So that definitely goes to, let's not cry about it. Let's do something. What is the kind of art that we can make? Yesterday I was leaving my friend's house and I was walking down the subway and I ran into this like young, kind of like he's young, but he's like a big music theater composer. And I stopped and we had a talk and we were talking about all the stuff going on. And then he mentioned, he's like, hey, you know what? I think I want to like, I have this musical with my writing partner and I think we want to make into a podcast. I jumped right in. I said, okay, I want to produce this podcast. How can I produce this podcast? Mm-hmm. That entrepreneurial spirit inside me. And if you want to carpe diem, you have to carpe diem. You have to, yeah, you're right. Because the institutions are gone. So when the institutions are gone, you have to create the work from nothing, from scratch. You got to find new ways to do it. And that could be debilitating or that could be very exciting. You choose your own adventure. And there are times where I'm just like, this is the worst. But then I have moments like running into who I ran into yesterday where I was excited again. I felt like a little kid again. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to make this thing. And then all of a sudden to think of like, oh, if we could do this and how are we going to sell it? And what's the da 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 da? And it made me excited again. But you're right. You have to be an entrepreneur and be an artist at the same time now. Yeah, you have to.
It'll be really interesting to talk to you after I play this show. You know, I'm doing this drive-in show in Prince Edward County in a couple of weeks. And so that'll be my first sort of experience after driving back across the country again, Allie, because I'm too scared to fly. Welcome to the world now. But
well, I just bought Air Canada stock, so can you please fly for me, Torkel? I need you back on the plane. I got to get that stock. Yeah, no. I just,
ladies and gentlemen, Allie Moman is now in charge of Air Canada. If you have any complaints about their service in the past or future, please get in touch with us. Soft Revcast. Allie will address your situation.
Yo, did you hear?
But
But listen, there's some other shit going down. So the musical Diana, which was in previews, was about to go on Broadway. It was directed by Christopher Ashley, who directed Come From Away.
I'm assuming that's about Diana. Not Diana Ross, Diana.
You know, it's so funny. I went to Christopher Ashley, who directed Come From Away and directed this, I went up to him and I said, yo, bro, like, what about Dodie? Like, can't Dodie be there? What about me? Basically, so this, the musical ends before Dodie. So I always say to myself, if Dodie was there, I'd be there. But Netflix.
Hey, let's write that musical. Dodie! Exclamation point.
Yeah. You know, Diana, what about Dodie? Dodie. So Netflix is they're going to do like a live production with no audience. They got approval from Actors Equity and they're going to do it and Netflix is going to show it. And then they're still going to open in 2021, 2022, 2024, whatever. It got me thinking, like, with the promotion of Actors Equity. Actors Equity in America and Canadian Actors Equity here, there should be, I don't want to sound like Trump, but we got to cut some regulation right now. At this point, there should it should not be with the fucking permission. It should be like, damn fucking right, we are allowing you guys to do live recordings of productions because that's all there is. Why are they stopping?
I'm going to take it one step further, actually, Ali, and say that I'm not sure why Equity exists right now.
There's nothing.
Particularly Canadian Actors Equity, who are not actually a union and have no actual collective bargaining power. Why are they involved on any level? And if you're paying Equity dues, please get in touch with us and tell me why. This is what I'm saying, is that I feel like we are all...
Well, I am paying Equity
including
dues.
Myself,
are you paying Equity dues?
But... I haven't been a member of Equity for years and years and years because I don't really fundamentally believe that it's a good thing for actors. That's a whole other conversation, which I know at least 50 people who listen to this podcast who are now standing in their living room saying, fucking Torque, but I don't care. I have thought long and hard about it. And I don't believe that Canadian Actors Equity has on balance been good for theater in this country. And I think it continues not to be. And I don't get, I feel that we are all in this place now of, yes, we're mourning the past. We were all living a life. We all wanted to get to the Stratford Festival or get to Broadway or, you know, pay our equity dues, become an equity member and all the protections and all the kind of cachet that is involved in being a quote unquote professional artist. I'm sorry. It's as hard for me to take as it is for you. Believe me, it's over. It's gone.
Yeah, the party's over.
And it might come back. I don't know. But right now, anyone who tells you that they can help from an institution is fucking lying to you. They're lying to you.
Yeah.
Because the only thing that will save you right now is your impulse to create. And your impulse to take what you've created and sell it to whoever is within a 5-mile radius of you. And that is just the facts. And like, yeah, are we back in the 19th century? Yes, we are. Does that fucking suck? Kind of. Does it mean that actors have been, and artists, musicians, painters, writers have been relegated in some respects to what they were in the 19th century, namely just above like street people and sex workers and people who sold, you know, like, yeah, that's what it means. It means we are underneath the boot heel of capitalism, along with sex workers and people who sell drugs and people who exist on the fringes of society. Government in North America has made it clear that they don't give a solitary fuck if there's any culture left at the end of this. I'm sorry, with all respect due to Stéphane Gibeau and Justin Trudeau, not good enough, guys. You made nice noises for a couple of months, and now you've abandoned us. And it gets worse and worse and worse. I just talked to a friend recently who runs a theater who had to walk in there and say, the wage subsidy is ending, and half of you are going to be gone in 2 weeks. Like, we are facing massive, massive suffering in the world of art, and the response by the mass media and by government is silence. So fuck them. Make something, get your lemonade stand out, and try and sell it to your neighbors. because that's all we've got right now. So if equity tells you you can't do
something,
that's
all we've got.
Tell them to go fuck themselves. Like,
do it.
I just don't get.
Just do it.
I don't get why you'd say anything other than that. Like, they have no right and no business to tell
any
of
us surprised.
What to do.
Yeah, I was profoundly, profoundly, I mean, I wasn't surprised when I first heard that, you know, Actors Equity is with the permission. Jesus Christ. But it's also, you know, look, I don't fully believe this, but I'm going to say it anyways. It's making me go like, you know, that in Canada, they gave $500 million to the Heritage Foundation. And a lot of that's going to go to like arts organizations. In the UK, £1.57 billion, all essentially going to arts organizations. And as time goes by and I think about how long this pandemic is going to last and how kind of seismic the change it's going to be, I think to myself like, wow, funds misdirected. And this goes to why I am pushing and I support an Arts New Deal in which, you know, to quote Jennifer Lena, fund artists, not organizations. Because we're the ones right now that if you dropped, I know this sounds ridiculous, but Torkel and I, without really an idea, each one of us individually or together, if you just gave us money to create something with whatever we have here, we're not bound by any legacy. An organization, when you give them money, they are bound by years upon years of legacy, donors, subscribers, everything. But with us is we can be nimble. In ways when you give it to, I'm sounding like a fucking conservative right now, but when you put money into the pocket of the people, I really think so. I just think like all this money is going, if you're going to give the money, let it equally also go to like individuals as well too, but all this money is going into these arts organizations that we don't even know if they're going to survive or if they're even going to be legitimate or if they're even going to be legitimate when this is over.
Let me push back on that a little bit because it's interesting you bring that up. It is very, very difficult to get any leader of a cultural institution to come out and speak on the record in public about what their thoughts are right now. And you can make of that what you will. You know, you can blame that on uncertainty on their part about what exactly they're going to do. I think that's part of it. I think part of it is what they would call cancel culture and the fear they have that if they are not appropriately orthodox in their politics and in their intentions, that they will be slated and attacked. I think that there's a number of reasons why you can't get people to put their name to this argument. So I'm going to make it on their behalf. It seems to me like Soft Revolution is to some degree becoming a podcast that is about the dismantling of artistic institutions. With Dave last week, who was definitely advocating, not the dismantling of, but certainly the questioning of why funds were always relegated and delegated through organizations that were run by boards of directors, et cetera. And now the pandemic, and then Ravi as well brought that issue up, and you and I have discussed it. And I, for a long time, have been an advocate, I think, when I look back on my, you know, my drunken rantings over the last 20 years, a lot of it has been about how I feel like boards of directors and institutions create stasis and create a kind of constipation in art. However, is there a trap here? Because if we let these institutions die, they will never come back. They won't be rebuilt in a different image. They will be gone. The kind of capital and the kind of cultural support, the kind of general population support that was required to build organizations like the Stratford Festival or Lincoln Center or the Metropolitan Museum of Art, these places were built in an era where culture was fundamentally agreed upon to be important. And that exists today in Europe, but it no longer exists in North America. So when you're advocating for defunding these organizations, I think it's important to be aware that if you do it, don't expect them to ever return. And what that means is, it means that the kind of art that those institutions are capable of making, namely art that is high budget, that has high outreach, and that they potentially can show to an audience that is not just made up of rich people, but made up of students, diverse populations, etc. You are forfeiting that possibility in our culture. And you are saying, no, we want to build culture back up from the ground. We want to have everything be small again. We want to suffer. We don't want to have a middle class. And that's valid, man. That is a valid idea. But I think we have to walk carefully.
That's not what I'm saying. Yeah, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that, like, if you, it should be equal because, you know, it just has to be equal. Like, if you're going to give X to an to organizations, we need to give Y to artists. It needs to be the same. Because right now, those arts organizations, they're not making work. They're empty. The buildings are empty. The majority of people that are employed through those arts organizations are people who generally are employed when art is being made and it's being presented. That's not happening right now. So we're basically like the government is propping up, our tax money is propping up these buildings. And that's fine. I think they should survive. It was of no fault of their own that this happened. And it was also not our fault that this happened. Right? So we should be getting equal kind of consideration and support. Because in the same way that, yes, totally, we want all these organizations to stay. I'm grateful for them. I think they're wonderful. But at the same time, in this pause, in this moment, we need to also recognize that now's the time to recognize that maybe money needs to go to artists to create art in this new world that we're in. And because we don't know what's on the other side here. We really do not know what's on the other side here. And I just, that's how I feel, man. I just, and I don't feel it all the time. I don't feel it all the time. Today's Wednesday. If you would have caught me on Tuesday, I would have maybe have said something different.
Yeah.
You know, but I do totally agree that these organizations are valuable and they need to be there. But at the same time, so are artists. And if you went to every single artist and you said all that money that has been given out to these organizations, how much of it has trickled down? How much of it has trickled down? I think the answer is going to be like nothing. Nothing has trickled down. So I think that's a fair statement to make. And right now, again, I'm just going to repeat, organizations are bound by their legacy, but an individual artist or a group of artists are not. We are not bound by anything. We can be nimble right now. I can get together and I could do it in a podcast. I could do it online. I could do it through video. I could do it through, anyway, I'll do it outside. We have that nimbleness, right? That
an organization and going back to what Moya said, you know, what we have the nimbleness to respond to what people need right now, and I think that the people do need art.
And there's one more thing I want to say.
Yeah,
I just want to say we also don't have the overhead of an organization. A production that can be done in a creative fashion with a minimal kind of tech can give individual artists far more bang for their buck. It can give them that thing you spoke about, the organization. And it's true. I talked about this with Ravi. It was like going to the Shaw Festival, Come From Away, Stratford, doing a real season on a TV show. I was like, oh my God, middle class life making art. But now that we can't do it that big, because this issue is not only applicable to live performance, the Good Doctor was supposed to start in Vancouver. We started this podcast of you talking about Vancouver. They had to shut that shit down before the first day because of coronavirus issues between the union, right? Hudson and Rex, thank God the dog didn't get COVID, but somebody on Hudson and Rex got COVID. So they had to shut down for a few days. Most productions cannot get insurance, right, in Ontario. A handful of them have, but the rest of them are basically ultimately on pause. So these big, huge projects and these big, huge organizations can't do it. But a small group of artists, whether it's an individual or a handful, can. And with very minimal overhead, they could make something wonderful that actually will put food on their table. So that's why I kind of think like, yes, let the organization survive, but don't forget that we as artists can make something in which to give ourselves a middle-class life. So that's,
you know, it inspires a thought in me, Ali, that what you just said makes me think that, you know, we've been advocating for an Arts New Deal. And I think that is ultimately, that would be an incredible outcome of all this bullshit. But I think maybe a more palatable pitch to the government could be the idea of microloans to artists. You know, that why should we not essentially become small businesses, right? And incorporate, pay taxes as small businesses. But if you want to be a small business as an artist, where can you go to get that $5,000 that lets you
Germany,
get the video equipment?
Germany.
You need? Well, there you go. Exactly. Germany.
No, but Germany, set up a program. Germany set up a program. 5,000 euros to any freelancer. A freelancer. And they don't ask you what you're doing. You don't have to write a 20-page thing to send to CBC. You don't got to do any of that shit. They just say, here it is. Yeah. Make it. Right?
So, and you don't have to. And this is the thing about the scarcity mentality that I always talk about, that great phrase that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez used. She said, you know, the left gets caught up in a scarcity mentality and ends up fighting with each other over scraps when we really should be turning our gaze to the people who are starving us to death. And this is true too of this, right? Is that in North America, we are in this kind of death struggle between institutions that we see as being historically racist and the notion of individual artists. And there shouldn't be this argument. Yes, institutions should change, but here's the truth, okay? They have been. They have been changing. The last 10 years of cultural institutions in Canada and in the United States have seen huge changes in terms of the kind of casting, the kind of work that's being done, the kind of shows that are being put up, whether it's the world of literature or art or drama or music. There has been, I think, a good faith effort. Not enough yet. There's a long road to go, but that progress has been being made. And then COVID hit, and then Black Lives Matter hit, and there seemed to be this discussion around institutions representing nothing but stasis and nothing but kind of the intractability, the impossibility that we'd ever achieve something within that institutional framework. I think it's unfair to say that, but I also agree with you that you can't depend on institutions right now. And institutions will change when we change. Institutions will change in response to societal change. So why is it either or? Why can't we have both? Why can't the government step up and be grown-ups and actually look at their own fucking statistics and know that culture and art are a massive part of our GDP. They're a massive part of keeping people from fucking killing themselves, from having mental health issues. They're a massive part of our education system. They're a massive part of what makes life worth living. When is any journalist, and I'm talking to you out there, journalists have, I love you, but I'm going to give it to you real. You're quite thin-skinned, I've noticed. Anytime somebody calls you out when you don't do your shit right, you get very upset, but I don't care, Rosie Barton, who got mad at me on Twitter. When is someone going to ask Justin Trudeau, what are you going to do for arts and culture in this country? This is an extinction level event. Where is the plan? And why is it okay to just have no answer? It's not fucking good enough. And here we are fighting over whether we should have microloans or whether the Stratford Festival should exist. Fuck that, man. That is a false dichotomy.
They both should.
It's a
both.
False argument. They both should. Yeah. They both fucking should. So, like, I don't really want to get caught up in this.
Yes, we and.
So I don't want to get caught up in a conversation where it's like, if I think the Stratford Festival should exist, then I don't care about Black Lives Matter. It's just false. It's a false dichotomy to make, and we've got to stop making it. We need to pull together here, people. And we need to put pressure on the people. Yeah, and we need to put pressure on the people who can actually affect change, namely the political and the corporate class. So if you've got some, you know, if you wake up pissed off and you feel the compulsion to go on Twitter and yell at somebody, stop picking low-hanging fruit. Go for the top guys, because there's nothing right now that some guy who runs a theater you don't like can do for you, man. They're fucked too. Yeah. So like, let's go after the big boys and try and get society in general to finally wake up to the fact that art is dying and that a life without art is called bare existence. And I'm not down for it. And I don't think many people are, you know? Anyway,
I'll say one more final thing.
Yeah, go.
I want to say one. Isn't it really interesting that, like, So in my condo, it's a brand new condo. It's done, but there's still a lot of construction. You got to see these construction workers, man. They don't give a shit. They're touching each other. They're close to each other. They don't fucking care.
Yeah.
And I'm just like thinking about it. I'm like, what the fuck is it? Our industry, God bless us. I'm not saying this is a bad thing, but we are so good. We're so careful. Aren't we supposed to be like the carefree? Fuck it. We're going to do whatever we're going to do. But we're like, no, we follow every safety protocol, blah, blah, blah. Just an observation. Just an observation about our people. Anyways,
it's fascinating. And let me say that to this, because that is so interesting. I you know, I've been driving across this country. It's like, people just don't give a fuck. Like, there's just 20, 30 people hanging out. It's like, but artists are, you know, tied in knots about whether or not we can do a show for 20 people. And I think it has to do, I think it's obvious that we are empaths. You know, we're people who have big imaginations and we care about other people, and our jobs entail trying to empathize and contact with other people and connect with their experience. And so our sense of the possibility that we might make others sick is highly developed. But I also think that that theater schools and universities, the creeping academic presence in the world of art, has codified and kind of dogmatized being an artist in such a way that you have to signal constantly that you are a very good child, that you do the right things, you have the right opinions, you recycle your cups, you do all these things. And let me say, I speak as a cup recycler. Like, I'm not, this isn't the Joe Rogan show. I'm not suggesting that being an asshole is necessary to being an artist. But I do think that there is a kind of orthodoxy that has crept into the process of making art that is a little dangerous, because it means that we don't have the possibility for a dynamic to shift quickly, and that when we get into an emergency situation like this, as you say, and we need to be nimble, we aren't, because we're very married to our orthodoxy and to our sense of being good little boys and girls and doing the right thing. And I think that there's a balance that we have to find moving forward in the world of art. Like, I don't want to do a concert where anybody gets ill. But I have been doing concerts for 25 years, and I know for a fact that people have gotten ill at concerts of mine. People have people have been killed in car accidents driving home from concerts of mine. Bad shit happens, you know? People have misinterpreted my lyrics and committed suicide and written my lyrics as part of their suicide note. Like, that shit's real. Art is not your mom. Art is not here as a benevolent force in the world. Art exists like trees do. Art exists because it exists. And sometimes sometimes it is an amoral force and a dangerous thing. And we cannot tame it to the point where we rely on bosses to make it possible to do it. We have to be willing to accept some risk here, folks, whether it's financial risk to ourselves, emotional risk to ourselves, or risks to our audience. And this is not a suggestion that we forget about COVID-19 protocols. This is a suggestion that we adapt to COVID-19 and face the fact that, like, it isn't going to be easy to be an artist for the next few years. If you thought it was hard before, it's about to get 100 times harder. So, like, as I said earlier, if you don't think you can hack it, I would stop right now, because it's not going to get any fucking easier. Let's get to politics before we get to our artistic our artistic choices for the week. Kamala? Not sure.
Kamala. She says like, pronounce my name like comma, like a comma, punctuation, la.
Right.
Kamala.
Kamala Harris.
Harris.
Joe Biden. Sleepy Joe, Kamala Harris, Sleepy Joe, which is like, I think is like a sign of Trump's weakness in this election, is like, you know, being sleepy is really quite pleasant. Like, I think we'd all take sleepy right now over totally psychopathic. Let him sleep through the whole term.
I have dreams of going to bed and just waking up when this is over. So give me the sleep. Give it to me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Sleepy Alley, Sleepy Torque. I think everybody should be sleepy right now. But he has selected, I think, three-term U.S. Senator from California, Kamala Harris, former U.S. prosecutor.
No, one-term. She was...
only one-term.
2016,
okay.
She was elected. Yeah, she was a district
attorney. Wow, huge influence.
For San Francisco. And then the district attorney for California. The attorney general, pardon me.
That's how outsized her influence has been in one term. She's had a huge influence on Capitol Hill and in the Senate. She's an extremely impressive person. Ali, your thoughts on the pick from a cultural perspective. Do you think Kamala Harris is the woman to tame the woke generation into voting for Sleepy Joe? Or have they, once again, has the Democratic Party shot itself in the foot?
The only time where I felt what I felt about Kamala Harris when I first heard her speak was when I heard Barack Obama speak in 2004 at the DNC.
Wow.
I came across Kamala Harris, yes, in 2016. At that time, I was doing a show at Berkeley, and she's from Oakland, and so she's just a mainstay there, and her name kind of popped up, and then I started to listen to this woman. And it's the same thing I had when I saw Obama in 2004. I said, this woman's going to be president, and she's a superstar. When her campaign first started, she was like the favorite. She was number one. And again, she was a rock star. She is a political animal. She just knows what to do. She's highly empathetic. Her story is incredible. She is deeply intelligent. She's funny. She talks like a human being, which to me is so fucking important. She's not robotic in any way whatsoever. Do I think that she'll be able to tame the woke left? Yeah. And I'm actually seeing signs of it already. There's this guy, I don't know if you know him, Sean King. He used to write for the New York Daily News.
Yes, of course.
And,
yes.
Yeah, he's big. He's big in that whole Bernie crowd. But he came to my attention in 2016 because he would always write at the time when it was mathematically impossible for Bernie Sanders to win, not on super delegates, but pledge delegates. He would write these like 3,000 word, like I call it gaslighting pieces of just like bullshit, bullshit, bullshit of like, this is how Bernie can win and they're stealing it from him. So I don't have a good soft spot for Mr. Sean King. However, Sean King came out yesterday and actually endorsed her and said, I'm excited about her. And even though I have issues, she's learning and she's growing. And I could see that she's evolved on certain things, which I was like, whoa, 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 Mr. Cancel. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Where'd this come from? But I think that she can tame. I think she's just one of those candidates that like, it's hard to like hit her because Trump is trying to make it out like, A, she's, you know, she's a crazy lefty, but then it's also like, no, she's, you know, what about the criminal justice stuff she did? She's actually law and order. So I saw her today with Joe Biden for the first time doing her speech. And I said the exact same thing. This woman is a star. Pence, you're fucked. Trump, you're fucked. And the only way out is for Trump to steal this election or drop out.
You never know. Yeah. I think it's a canny choice actually, because I think that, you know, I'm certain that was the issue when they were thinking about who to nominate. I mean, Joe Biden is not anybody's idea of an ideal candidate, I don't think, except maybe a retirement community's idea of an ideal candidate. But there he is. He's the old guard of the Democratic Party, and he's, you know, I don't think a great guy, but not a terrible guy, and certainly better than the worst person that ever lived. But Kamala Harris, you know, I think is a smart choice because I think that she does kind of silence the notion that they did not pick someone progressive enough. And in a way, I think the progressive argument hoisted itself on its own petard with its addiction to identity politics. If identity is what is most important in the political question right now, and that is the argument made by many on the very far left, I count myself as one of those people, by the way, then Kamala Harris, as a South Asian African-American woman, you know, if identity is important to you, and you think it's important to have a person of color, and you think it's important to have a woman, well, what you got to say now? Are you now going to start to nitpick about the fact that you don't agree with her policies when she was a prosecutor in California? I mean, how far are you willing to take this bullshit? So I kind of feel like,
and on top,
it was a smart play on their part to kind of silence the Twitter brigade, because I do think that she answers both questions. She's a moderate Democrat. She makes progressive noise, but ultimately her voting record is moderate. But she does represent a massive leap forward, should she be elected, in terms of possibilities, right? I mean, she would be the natural heir and become a Black woman president. And that would be a new plateau in terms of
a Black South Asian
human rights. So, right. So I think it's a smart choice. Now, the only caveat is, of course, that if politics over the last 10 years has shown us anything, it's that while people do love to be racist, God knows they love to be racist, what they really, really love is to be misogynistic.
It's to be sexist.
People really, they just hate women. Yeah. So I'm hoping, and that includes women sometimes, oddly enough, like 60% of white women voted for Donald Trump, despite the fact that there were 34 allegations of sexual assault against him. And there was a tape of him, you know, claiming to have sexually assaulted someone. So I'm hoping that the media does not Hillary Clinton Kamala Harris, because Hillary Clinton, in many respects, I think, is a loathsome character, but certainly was qualified to be president. And please God, I wish she had
been. So qualified.
And I think if they start to sort of, you know, is Kamala Harris too mean? Is she too grumpy? Is she too severe? If I start hearing that shit from the media, I'm going to lose my shit. Could you please just, I know misogyny sells ads. I know misogyny pays your bills. I understand everyone. Everybody loves to hate on women. If we could just save it for 3 months so we could get this piece of shit out of office, I think we'd all really appreciate it. Signed, the human race.
Signed, the human race. And I really do think, but I do think that that's the reason why people are like just saying, you know what, even the really, really left, the moderates are all lining up on here is that she's both conventional and she's exciting. But I really think they're like, you know what, eye on the prize, dipshit's got to go.
Yeah, good choice, Joe. We're with you. We vote Biden-Harris in 2020.
Right. Harris.
Folks, that's Soft Revolution for the week. We hope you enjoyed our chat. Next week, we're going to have Zawn Wiley on to talk about seriously revolutionary work that she's undertaking in Rikers Island in New York City, attempting to bring art to the prisoners there. Really like at the core of what we started this podcast for and the kind of people we admire most. So we're going to try and bring you more of those folks who are doing stuff with art that isn't about institutions, it isn't about getting famous, and sometimes it's not even about getting paid. It's about using art as a weapon of love to save our motherfucking souls. Ali, what's your artistic pick this week?
Okay, yeah. So my artistic pick, yes, is this man by the name of Ben Lonkel Soul. I guess that's how you pronounce his name. It's L-O-N-C-L-E. Yeah, Ben Lonkel Soul. And he's like a jazz singer, but he also has a side where he does some soul music as well too. He has one of the most incredible cover albums of Frank Sinatra you will ever hear. Pick that up. But he just came out with a new album called Addicted to You, and it's fantastic. So I'll play it out. What do you got?
I'm going to check that out this week. My pick, I'm in Tofino right now visiting some family. And Tofino is the furthest west you can get in Canada. It's a beautiful little place on Vancouver Island, absolutely extraordinary. And there is an amazing art gallery out here that contains the work of only one artist. And his name is Roy Henry Vickers. And he has his own art, his own gallery here in Tofino. He has Haida ancestry, Heiltsuk ancestry, Tsimshian ancestry, but he's a First Nations artist out here, and he's from this part of the world. And he does these extraordinarily beautiful paintings of this part of the world. And they're very expressionistic. They're very kind of, they do resemble a lot of the work of a Group of Seven, actually, which is a group of artists in the early part of the century in Canada who painted Northern Ontario. But they are exquisitely beautiful. And when you come to this part of the world, he, you know, his work is shown all over the world. He's very famous, and his pictures are in galleries in Europe. And sometimes I'll see them out of context when I'm going through a city or I'm in a museum, and I'll think, wow, that's such an extreme view of what that part of the world, the West Coast of BC, is like. And then when you get here and you realize he is actually a realist, that he is painting the extremity of the nature here and the kind of hugeness of it with enormous profundity and power. So look him up online, find a book of his. It's all about nature. It's very much away from this world of ours that is so fucked up. I find looking at his paintings very soothing and very sort of grounding. And it's just beautiful art by a great First Nations artist. So go check it out. Roy Henry Vickers.
Beautiful. I'm looking at it now. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, gorgeous stuff. Folks, that's Soft Revolution for this week. I'm Tork Campbell. That was Ali Moman. We're trying our best out here. We know you are too. Take care of yourself. Wear a fucking mask. If I see you without a mask, I swear to God, I'm going to be so upset. Wear a fucking mask. Take care of yourself.
Property management from Torco's building is listening. Please, please put the signs up for Torque. Please.
Yeah. Paul, can you do something, please? Thanks so much for listening, you guys. Be safe. Start something beautiful and keep doing it. And we'll see you next week.
See you next week, man.
When I get nothing but you to hold so tight. Alright. Two trees coming from the same soul, the same seeds. I love the way you sway through the same breeze. Just two trees, two trees. Two trees, two trees coming from the same soul, the same seeds. I love the way you sway through the same breeze. Just two trees. No, we can't go wrong. You know we'll never fall, cause these roots too long. Just in beside me, how are we gonna grow so high? Together rising all the way up into the sky. Oh yeah. Two trees coming from the same soul, the same seeds. I love the way you sway through the same breeze. Just two trees, two trees. Two trees, two trees. Coming from the same soul, the same seeds. I love the way you sway through the same breeze. Just two trees, two trees. Same soul, same seeds. I love the way you sway through.